history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories buried sometimes decades deep in the memories of people right around you might just blow your mind. And our perspective is always enhanced after we take a little time to listen. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we end up learning so much that would be hard to pick up anywhere else. We're educated, we're entertained, and we are continually inspired by these members of our greatest generation. I was planning to introduce you today to a unique Chinese-American veteran of World War II, but I'm going to save that for next time, because I just couldn't let another D-Day anniversary go by without taking note of how two D-Day vets in particular continue to honor their fallen brothers by keeping the memory of that longest day and the invasion of Normandy alive. One of them was in Washington, D.C. this June 6th on D-Day's 74th anniversary. The other was in France. They were both actively engaged in things many nonagenarians wouldn't be able to pull off. And they both continue to inspire those with whom they come in contact. We'll start with 93-year-old Colonel Arnold Gabriel, one of the most accomplished musical conductors in the world. He was at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. on D-Day's 74th anniversary, conducting the D-Day Memorial Wind Band in the official commemoration and wreath-laying ceremony at the memorial. Exactly 74 years earlier, he was hitting Omaha Beach with the 29th Infantry Division. As Colonel Gabriel explained when we had the chance to interview him in front of an audience of high school students in Clovis, California.
We had planned for an invasion of France. We didn't know precisely where it was going to be, whether it was going to be Calais. Even the Germans were trying to guess where we were going to land. So we had practiced for months about landing on a beach. It was called Slapton Sands in England, which was similar to the beaches of northern France. So we knew that the day would be coming.
Before D-Day, there was a legendary tragedy at Slapton Sands, an Operation Tiger. It was a training exercise, but the Germans showed up right off the coast in U-boats and started gunning down the Americans and the British. You weren't there for that, were you?
That was just north of us. That was the 28th Division from Pennsylvania. And if you knew what the symbol of Pennsylvania is, it's like a bucket. But that's what they wore on their shoulder.
Right.
And it was red. And one of the German subs hit one of the landing craft of the 28th Division. And so from that day forward, we call them the Bloody Bucket Division. But, you know, the kind of gallows humor, you have to keep a sense of humor. We had a guy join us when we were in St. Lo. St. Lo is a city inland. We were supposed to take it D plus 7 days. It was D plus 45. That's how rough it was going inland. And when we finally got there, I was joined with my machine gun squad by a fellow that had been in the 82nd Airborne. And I said, what are you doing here with the 29th Division? He said, well, I don't want to jump anymore because I jumped with my brother on D-Day, and he left his boot on the beach. And his foot was in it. Not funny, but kind of gallows humor that keeps you alive in combat.
You were talking about what the Bloody Bucket Division wore on their arms. So you had the blue and gray, right?
The blue and gray, the north and the south, because it was National Guard from Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. So they were both the north and the south were involved in the National Guard with the 29th Division.
And you were part of a machine gun squad?
Yes, 30 caliber light machine gun.
I know that day is not easy to talk about, and I know that music is something that helped you heal from some of the scars that your whole experience in the war left you with. But what do you remember about that day? It's been called the longest day. It's certainly a day that changed the world. But from your perspective, from the time you hit the beach to the end of that day, what are some of the things that you did and experienced?
Well, it was fear, confusion, fright. A little bit of everything. Nobody landed where they were supposed to. Not the 82nd Airborne, who jumped before we hit the beach. We hit the beach way left of where we were supposed to, and I ended up with the 1st Division, which was on our left flank. I was then with the 116th Easy Company, and I said, I've got to get back to the 29th Division. And so total confusion. I didn't have my machine gun because I left that in the water. The water was up to my waist, and most of us either that deep or some have never made it, drowned before they got to the beach. But anyway, so I made my way back to the 29th and ended up with I Company, the 175th. And they said, we need a machine gunner. You're going to be with us now. I said, well, you better call E Company so they know I'm not dead. So that's what they did. So that whole day was nothing but confusion.
And I want to talk about something you said there. You're going into the water, and you had to leave your machine gun behind. Mm-hmm. Now, this is supposed to be not just your protection, but protection for a whole bunch of your fellow soldiers.
Right.
So now you don't have that. You're coming ashore, and I imagine that there's enemy gunfire and artillery all around you, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there were so many weapons that were dropped by people who did get ashore, who were killed. If you needed a weapon, there it was on the beach because the person who was carrying it was probably killed. And there's another quick fact. In a division, there are 15,000 men, 9,000 of which were combatants, frontline troops. And my son, who's writing my biography, did his homework and discovered that the 29th Infantry Division suffered more casualties in World War II in that 11 months from June 44 till May 45 when the war was over. We had 20,000 casualties. Amazing.
That's a heavy number.
Yeah.
And for you, 19 years old, halfway around the world from home, getting shot at without what you were supposed to have to protect you, what in the world was going through your mind?
Well, like I said, fright, confusion, just you weren't thinking very straight, just to survive.
Now, this may sound like a dumb question, but I'm sure a lot of these young people are wondering themselves about it. Were you scared? Did you think that was it? Did you think you were going to see another day beyond June 6th?
No. I never thought I'd live to be 90, but there was a time when I didn't think I was going to live 10 more minutes. That's what war was like.
I believe it. And we look at now, and I'm just looking at your schedule of all the places around the country that you're going to be sharing your talents musically and thinking of all the lives that you've touched, much less your children and grandchildren. You even have great-grandchildren yet?
I do. I have 13 grandchildren and one great-grandchild.
And none of them would be here if you had been one of those guys from your division who didn't survive past that day. And just to talk about some of your decorations in the war, and we're going to get to music, and it all ties together, and it's incredible the path that your life has taken. But you're a recipient two times over of the Bronze Star, which isn't easy to get. You earned the Combat Infantry Badge. If you guys ever see a veteran wearing a little blue rectangular badge with a rifle in the middle of it, that's a Combat Infantry Badge. You only earn that by being in combat, as Colonel Gabriel was. I'm sure you're not dying to talk about why you got this or why you got that, but from D-Day, that's just the beginning. I'm sure you had a whole lot of experience from that point on. What are some of the ones that stand out that remind you of how fortunate or blessed you are to still be around?
Well, I joined the 29th Infantry Division in Europe. As I said, they were there in 42. So I was a replacement. I trained in the United States as a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle. When I got to the 29th, they said, no, you're going to be a machine gunner. Oh, really? So they trained me on a machine gun. And what they told me, this was absolutely true fact, that the life expectancy of a 30 caliber light machine gun in combat is 3 days. That's what I had to look forward to. And so when we went ashore on D-Day, like I said, we were supposed to take St. Lô, the first big major city in France, in 7 days, and it was the middle of July, so it was about 45 days before we took St. Lô. I met two men who were replacements for my machine gun squad, Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith, and they were with me for 3 months. Now, that's unusual. Like I said, the expectancy was 3 days, so we became very close. I knew all about their family. And on January 9th, 1945, the three of us were in a machine gun or in a foxhole, and we were hit by a German mortar, and both of them were killed. So they're buried in Margraten Cemetery in Netherlands. And they had their families were looking for somebody that knew their father in combat. So they wrote to the Army Records Section, they wrote to the Veterans Administration, they wrote to everybody they could think of. And then a few years ago, as you know, we built the World War II Memorial. And so I was a charter member. So they wrote to the World War II Memorial and said, is Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith, you know what, where they might be? Because they didn't even know where they were buried. And they said, oh, yes, they're members. And I said, how can that be? They were killed back in 45. Well, it was a Staff Sergeant Arnold Gabriel who signed them up as charter members. And that's how they found me. And so we had become very, very close. Harry Ashoff had a 2-year-old son. And that 2-year-old son came to Washington 4 years ago. And I gave them the tour, took him to the World War II Memorial, and he's going to get his car to drive back to New Jersey. And he said, before I leave, he said, I want to ask you something. But before that, I want a hug. So he gave me a hug, and he said, will you be my dad? Mm.
That gets you.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of veterans who came home and met their first child for the first time at 3 or 4 years old because they'd been born while they were shipping off, or their wife was pregnant while they were shipping off. I've also met children who've had a lifelong quest, like your friend's son, to learn about their parents. So what you provided for him, holy moly, that's powerful. But there's another question that I have after hearing that story, and I bet some of you students are thinking the same thing. You said the three of you were all in the same foxhole, right?
Mm-hmm.
The mortar killed the two of them, but not you.
I was very lucky. I got a concussion and some bruises. I was authorized to get the Purple Heart, and I said, I can't get the Purple Heart. My two buddies were killed. I'm not going to get it for a few bruises, so I didn't get the Purple Heart.
I know this isn't easy to talk about again, but how do you deal with that? Again, you're still a young man, barely older than these kids at Clovis North High School here.
19 years old.
To have your two best friends who've been with you for months killed.
3 months, right. Yeah.
Not to mention what happened to you in the process. How do you process that and move on and continue to stay alive and fight the enemy?
Well, I didn't go right back to the front line. I stayed back with the kitchen unit, which was back in the rear area for 3-4 days until I regained my composure. My lieutenant gave me some advice, which is valuable for everybody in this room. I couldn't deal with reality. I couldn't deal about going back to the front line again. And Lieutenant Butler came to me and he said, I was still a private then. He said, Private Gabriel, he said, now you've got to get on your feet. You've got to get back to the front line and put that all behind you. I said, yeah, but Lieutenant, do you remember St. Lowe? Do you remember D-Day? He said, hold it right there. It's okay to look back. Just don't stare. Great advice for everybody. Because we all have things in our lives that were traumatic. But we have to put those things behind us and move on. And that's what I did. After the war was over, I was very confused. I was still only 20 years old when I was separated. And I had the war behind me at 20 years old. And I worked in a factory for 67 cents a day in a warehouse. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to be alone. I didn't want anybody to bother me. And my high school band director came to that factory. And he said, Arnold, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm making a living. He said, you're going to college. I said, I can't go to college. How can I compete with students like you, right out of high school, who are playing their instruments? I hadn't played anything but a machine gun for 3 years. And people who had played in military bands for 3 or 4 years. I can't compete with them. He said, you're going to college. He insisted. So he went to Ithaca College, which is his alma mater, paid my matriculation fee, waived my audition, literally pushed me into college. And he also went to the band director and the orchestra director and said, put this young boy in the first chair. Well, I knew I didn't deserve that. So I said, okay, I'll try it for a semester. And I did practice 3 and 4 hours a day so I wouldn't disappoint him or me. I figured out that the only way I was going to get through the war was to keep busy. And to this day, you know my schedule. There is no time for me to think about the war except for times like this. So when I was in college, when I was a sophomore, there was a vacancy for a choir director at a Baptist church, even though I was Catholic, in Cortland, New York. And I went to the pastor and I said, I would like to apply for the job. He said, have you ever conducted choirs? I said, oh, sure. Never had. And the Syracuse Drum and Bugle Corps, they were looking for directors. Have you ever conducted a drum corps? Sure. Never had. So I worked every single night of the week, played first chair in the band and the orchestra, graduated cum laude, the honor, senior honor society. I don't know how I did all of that. But very kept very busy. When the Korean War came about, I decided, well, I'm not going to go back to the infantry. And I knew that the Air Force was looking for band directors. So in 1951, I applied for a job as a band director in the Air Force and was accepted. And the same thing happened. I kept extremely busy by always doing more than was expected of me. Not so much that I thought it was necessary for my mission, but it was more for me to keep busy than anything else. There's another story I want to tell you very quickly. The 30 caliber light machine gun, every fifth round is a tracer. You know what a tracer is? It's a bullet that you can see. And the reason for that is you can see where your bullets are landing, right? But conversely, they can see where they're coming from, too. So they can zero in on you. So that's why you dig a lot of foxholes. Keep moving. I learned that another expression I use. You can't hit a moving target. So I keep moving.
The 70th anniversary of D-Day. Tell all of us where you were, what you were doing, and who you had with you.
We were sponsored by Music Celebrations out of Phoenix. And they formed 110 players from all over the United States. I think we had about 20 from Clovis in that band.
The Clovis Community Band, exactly.
Yeah. Yep. So we had 110, and we had rehearsals in Paris. And on the 4th of Paris, we did a concert at City Hall in Paris. And then on D-Day, June 6th, on Omaha Beach, and played a concert there. Again, it was very, very emotional. And somebody counted. We played, I think, 9 selections. And we had 8 standing ovations.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the audience like?
Well, they came from all over that Normandy area. And the little old ladies that were alive in World War II, not many men were because they were either killed or died since, come up and kiss me on both cheeks with tears in their eyes because I'm still, to them, a liberator.
You are. And if we were all to go there right now, there are a lot of things that we could see. I mean, we could see that same beach that they came ashore. You could even see some of the military equipment that was there at the time. You could see the little church in St. Mary Glees with a paratrooper still hanging from it, just as he was that day when John Steele got hung up on the steeple. There are a lot of things that we could see that remind us of it, but we weren't there. And you were. And here on a day, the 70th anniversary, when the President of the United States and all these other world leaders are there, you're there conducting a band, not just as something that's interesting to you, but something that you lived and something that killed your friends. What did that feel like to be in that spot at that moment doing what you were doing?
Well, the President of France was also there, along with the President Obama. And on YouTube, you can see the president giving the speech at the military cemetery where 9,600 people who died at Normandy are buried. And I'm sitting directly behind the president. When he finished his speech, he turned around and shook hands with, there were only about, I think, 20 or 30 veterans of D-Day who were there. And both presidents shook hands with me, and that's on YouTube. That, again, very, very moving.
I know. You don't stare when you look back. You made that clear to us, and I'm going to remember that. That's a powerful statement. But do you ever look back and say, why me? How did this all work out the way it did for me? Why am I the one that survived all of this, that has had all these opportunities, and here I am all these years later still going and having the privilege of honoring all those guys who aren't still here?
Well, yeah, there's almost a feeling of guilt. But on the other hand, I feel like I have to continue to give, that my life was spared. And as long as I can continue to give, I'm going to. And I have 3 contracts to conduct when I'm 100 years old. And I'm going to do it, by the way.
You have 3 contracts?
Yes, I do.
You've committed to it?
Yes.
You can't back out?
Nope.
I don't want to put any words in your mouth. I'm just always interested to understand how you understand it and how you grasp it. And I think it's kind of funny that here you told us you're a Catholic, but your first music job was in a Baptist church. You've conducted the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. You've done these things. Just music has bridged every possible divide.
And then I worked with the Tokyo Kasai, and Kasai is Buddhist. So all of our rehearsals were in a Buddhist temple, so you take your shoes off.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of stories there, but I'll move on. And when I was in Europe, I worked in Tehran, which was the center of Islam in those days.
Yeah.
And as you know, on my website, there's a picture of me and Pope John II, who was Catholic. So the Buddhists, the Mormons, the Islam, and Catholics. So when I go to heaven, I've touched all bases.
Well, maybe that answers my question, which was just...
Those are 4 of the highlights, by the way, yeah.
Yeah, and it's incredible. Very few people could have pulled that off. So I guess that's my question. What is your explanation for that? Do you believe that someone was pulling those strings for you? Do you think that's just the way it happened? You're the one who lived it, so what's your perspective?
Well, there's another old expression, there are no atheists in the foxhole.
Yeah, and you spent a lot of time in a foxhole.
Yeah, so you become a believer.
You mentioned the book. If that book turns into a movie, who do you think should play Colonel Gabriel?
Me. You see, that's optimism.
And clearly that optimism has not waned for Colonel Gabriel, who honored his late friends again this D-Day. I hope that book does become a movie someday, and if you'd like to read the book, The Force of Destiny, written by his son Michael, I have a link for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you can also find a video of what 96-year-old Tom Rice did this week. He jumped out of an airplane and parachuted down toward the same French countryside in which he landed 74 years ago. Hear his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.